All right, so I want to start off with a question to which hopefully you'll provide the answer I'm looking. What is it that you really want?
Like right now?
In a grander scheme of things.
The answer to that question.
Okay, fair enough. Anything else? What is it that you really want?
A painless life.
A painless life. Good, good answer. Yeah.
Inner peace.
Nice.
Success.
Success. Good thought, Becca. Wow.
No, where did you come up with that?
You just seem to read my mind. Well, if Becca's right, then you came to the right place tonight. Because I have a special treat for all of you.
Is it chocolate?
It is not chocolate. It is better than chocolate.
It's chocolate.
We are going to have our own little graduation ceremony. Okay? Right now. So after I read your name, I will present you with your diploma and everybody will clap for you. Bryce. Congratulations. Becca, congratulations. Eusebius.
Yeah.
Adam. Congratulations. Jane. Congratulations. Poe. Congratulations. Brittany. Veronica. Woo! Jack. Lauren. Congratulations. Laura. Shin. Congratulations. Dan.
Oh.
Mark. Hey. Congratulations. Rachel. Isn't that great? Uh-oh! All right, hold on quick. Okay, we're going to welcome them.
You guys ready?
Ready.
We're presenting something to you. What are you going to do now?
Screw it up.
Good answer. What a foreshadowing of what we're going to talk about tonight. All right, so.
He gives them out. He doesn't get it.
First, we're going to take a moment and admire my work.
Yeah, it's good.
You like the Yahweh and you like the title I gave myself?
I like the
representative.
Were you elected to that?
This is not a democracy.
that's word I write.
What's the word for a religiously ruled thing?
Theocracy.
That's what this is. Yahweh declared me his representative for the purposes of declaring you a success. All right, so stretching your imagination and thinking that this is a legitimate certificate of success.
Are you kidding? I'm framing this.
What would this mean? Like, if you were now a success, like your life had been a success, done, what would you feel?
Dead.
Dead, okay.
empty.
Panic. Why panic?
Yeah.
That's it? Crap.
That's it? Crap. What else to do? Okay. But don't you want to be a success?
Yeah.
Just not now?
What does that mean, to be successful?
What does it mean?
It means to get what you think that you want.
Get what you think you want. Okay, fair enough.
Set goals and reach them, you're successful.
Mm-hmm. So if you are a success, then there's nothing to do. Is that kind of the idea?
Other than
uh-oh.
Make more goals.
One more.
I should see what's coming.
Anna, you have come to the right place
you
tonight.
You should do this every week. People will never be late again.
Anna, congratulations. You are now a success. Does it feel good?
Yeah.
All right, so we're talking about success tonight because the biblical story that we're following, as kind of trying to go through the whole story, goes through this season where things are really good for a little bit. And then, of course, they're not anymore. But we want to think about what this is, how God works through success. It's obviously something we want, we shoot for it, we set goals, we want to get there, but then at the same time, it's kind of elusive, but it's also, as Jonathan said, once you get there, you have this question of, well, what then? It's kind of a funny time talking about success for me because it's been a hard week, just family-wise, and been tired, and sick kids, and emotional and behavioral problems, and so I've been kind of trying to reflect on success this week, and it's tricky because I think that's, for me, really what I want, and yet, once you get past kind of the school part of life, it's really hard to feel like a success, right? Because most of the things you end up wanting to be a success in are really hard to measure. And, you know, I remember when I was working in software, you'd get, like, yearly reviews, and that, and you maybe get a promotion. Like, that's kind of, like, the best thing you could have for success. But other than that, you know, your job, sometimes you feel like you do a good job, sometimes you feel like you don't, and there's kind of this dynamic. The things that I care about being a success in, being a successful parent, being a successful pastor, being a successful husband, like, I don't get a little certificate like this, you know? I wish I could. But I think you grow up in life kind of aiming for success by fairly measurable standards. And then you get to a place where the standards are really hard to measure. And so it becomes tricky. And I think God uses that in our lives to say, well, what, you know, what does it look like to be a success? How does God view that? I thought I might mention this as well. Speaking of success, it'd be hard not to acknowledge that we live in a part of the country that feels like we have finally become a success, right? So this is worth the wait. 52 years after moving... What's that?
That was 56. Oh, okay.
Well, this says 52 years after moving to San Francisco, Giants' first victory parade is an emotional tribute. Sam Baca, a 63-year-old Hunters Point native, says this, "I've waited my whole life for this day."
Wow.
He actually says this, "Now I can go to my grave and relax." Goes to the parade, and then he goes to his grave. But that's what we said. Uh-oh.
One more.
I think Joe will be the last because we have to move on. But, Joe, you came just in time.
Yeah.
Congratulations. You are now a success. Nice work. So the thing about this is that why do we get so excited about this? Why would this man say he waited his whole life for this day? Why?
takes our mind off our troubles.
Takes our mind off our troubles, yeah. Or adds to them, depending on if you've won or lost.
Win.
Right, yeah, what'd you win? What else?
For this one moment, life is fair.
Wow. For this one moment, life is fair, okay?
It's clearly, the rules are clearly defined between the foul lines.
Yeah, this is pretty measurable, right? I mean, I heard one of the players say, we are now the best in the world. At the moment, right? until the next season. But for now, success has been achieved. Like, they did it, you know? It's not like the rest of life where you, you know... My kids say I'm the best daddy in the world, but, like, they're not teenagers yet, so that's... that's slightly less than measurable. I think one of the biggest temptations for us living in our world is to interpret our lives according to different stories, according to the stories that our world gives us. And one of the things I think we want to do is we want to have stories that frame our lives. And I think Genesis is right. This is why we like sports. This is why we like TV. This is why we like things where we can kind of see some other story, see some other plot line that goes through ups and downs, and it kind of takes us away from our own. And we kind of superimpose ourselves on it. So this is our story now. You know, the Giants have won, and because I happen to live in the city that pays their salaries, I'm part of the story now. This is my story. My team has won. And I think probably the most important thing for us as Christians is to view our lives in light of God's story. We talk a lot about interpreting the Bible and how do you read it and interpret it and see what it means. But I think the better way to think about it is the Bible presents this story, which if we immerse ourselves in it, we allow this book and the story God has told to interpret us. That this is the story of the world. And as we live our lives and we go through various ups and downs and experiences and have struggles and successes and relationships and conflict and whatever, this is the story that we use to interpret our lives. What is going on? What is this that I'm feeling? What should I feel? What can I expect? What is true of me? What is true of the world? This is the story that forms the background. And yet, we live in a world that gives us all sorts of stories that we use to interpret our lives. Our parents give us stories about, you know, how they grew up, or this is how you're supposed to live to be fulfilled, to have a happy life. Our companies give us stories. Our schools give us stories. Our friends give us stories, big picture things that we're supposed to use to interpret our lives. But if we follow Jesus, then the story of him and how God reveals himself through that man, who is God himself, that becomes the story that tells us what our story means. And that's the point of kind of this series, of going through the story of the Bible. It's not just, you know, your biblical knowledge is poor, so we need to study up so we know what happened in the Bible. The point is to kind of, and that's why it's titled Experiencing the Epic. We're not just learning the story. The goal is to see how this story really is our story. So tonight, there's just one very simple thing that I want us to learn. Three simple words, and yet what we're going to see as we go through this is how we don't really believe this, and we really have a hard time accepting it. God brings success. Three simple words. God brings success. That's part of the picture, part of the story that the Bible tells. And yet we're going to find out, I think, that we have questions about that statement. That we doubt it's really God who brings it. We doubt that what he brings is success. And we doubt that he'll ever get around to bringing it. And so, as we look through this story in this particular episode in the life of the nation of Israel, we're going to see how those questions get answered and hopefully kind of find our own stories parallel in it. So, first thing, we're going to start out with David. David comes out of nowhere, right? I'm going to start off by reading from 1 Samuel 16. If you remember kind of where we are in the story, God's people went through this season that we talked about last week of chaos, where they were ruled by judges. They were ruled by various leaders that God would rise up. They weren't kings. They didn't have kind of kingly authority. And it was a hard season for the nation of Israel. So they asked for a king. They said, the nations around us have a king. And yeah, we know, God, you're supposed to be our king, and we're supposed to think that way, but we want a flesh and blood king. We want somebody to lead us. So God said, okay, how about Saul? Saul was everything you'd expect from a king. The accounts in the Bible say over and over again, he was a head taller than anybody else in Israel. He was a tall guy. He was a strong guy. He was a natural leader. If he were in a room, you'd go, that's the king. That's the guy that God would choose as king. He was an obvious choice. And yet, he ended up failing in his job as king. God rejected him because he was arrogant, essentially. And so, we get to 1 Samuel 16. God has rejected Saul, and this is what happens. I'm going to start off in verse 5. Samuel has been sent to find the next king of Israel. He's come to this city in Bethlehem, and the elders have asked him, why are you here? He says, I come in peace. Actually, I'm going to pick up in verse 6. So he asks Jesse, one of the prominent men in this city, and his sons to come to a sacrifice. Verse 6 says, when they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab. This is one of Jesse's sons, and thought, surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord. This guy must be it. He looks like kingly material. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Then Jesse called Abinadab and had him pass in front of Samuel. But Samuel said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. Jesse then had Shema pass by, but Samuel said, nor has the Lord chosen this one. Jesse had seven of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, the Lord has not chosen these. So he asked Jesse, are these all the sons you have? They're still the youngest, Jesse answered, but he's tending the sheep. Samuel said, send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives. So he sent and had him brought in. He was ruddy, with a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, rise and anoint him. He is the one. So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. Samuel then went to Ramah. So if you remember when we looked at Moses, one of the things we noticed about Moses is that he was a leader that seemed to come out of nowhere. God simply chose him. He wasn't looking to be chosen. He wasn't looking to deliver God's people, but God said, you're the guy that's going to lead my people. It's the same thing here with David. David is the youngest of eight brothers. Now, in a society like this, age, birth order meant everything. And one of the interesting things throughout the Old Testament is God consistently chooses the younger. He consistently surprises the cultural expectations of who should be a leader. Larry King is quoted as saying this, those who have succeeded at anything and don't mention luck are kidding themselves. Well, I think what Larry King recognizes is that you don't succeed strictly by hard work, by making it happen for yourself, by, you know, you don't have all the power to make it work. He recognizes it as luck. But from this story, we can see that what happened here is that God chose David. He chose him to be the king. Why? Why did God choose David? What do you guys think? Zach knows a little bit about this because we're in a group talking about David.
Well, the text implies that there was something about David's heart.
Something about David's heart. Say again, Ron.
Why did God choose David?
I was reading, it says, but the Lord looks at the heart.
Yeah, the Lord looks at the heart. When God rejected Samuel, he said, I found somebody, a man after my own heart. That's how David is described.
Rejected Saul.
What's that? Rejected oh, sorry, when the Lord rejected Saul, right. He said, I found another king, a man after my own heart. And yet, we know the story of David a little bit. Was he a model of purity? Not exactly. He had some pretty significant poor decisions that he made in his life. There's something about his heart. And so God says, you are going to be king. We try really hard to be a success. Would you say that's accurate? Say a lot of the things you do in life, a lot of the decisions you make, a lot of the sacrifices you make are so that you can be a success in some arena of life. We're taught to do that, right? Our school system teaches us that. Our social system teaches us that, that you need to try hard. And if you try hard, you'll eventually be a success, right? There's this one quote I like. Did I get it? Oh, yeah. I like this one. This is from W.C. Fields. He said, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Then quit. There's no point in being a damn fool about it. I like that. But our culture teaches us, keep trying. Try to be a success. And our efforts, we're led to believe that our efforts produce results, right? That we have power over making things happen in our lives. This is one of the things we'll see over and over again as we look at this biblical story, that God is the one that acts. We talked about this at the beginning. God creates us. We talked about this the second episode. God is the one who calls us. We don't create our own calling. And so here again, we see that it's not us who makes it a success, who decides, I think I'll be king of Israel now. I think I'll lead this nation into the glory days. It's God. So the first thing that I think we generally don't believe about my statement, God brings success, is that we don't really think it's God who brings success. We really think it's up to us. We think that we have to try, that we have to work, that we have to get it right. The truth is, that is a exhausting way to live, right? Being responsible for our own success is what kills us. It's what drives us to be so busy and so tired and so worn out and so stressed and so empty, because we really can't ever get to it. So the first thing that we really need to be convinced of, and the first thing that we see through the life of David, is that it is God who brings success. Now, David doesn't just sit there. It's not like God anoints him as king and he says, all right, I'm going to kick back in my palace and live the good life. Feed me the grapes, fan my face, you know? He does stuff. He rises to the occasion. And particularly the first part of David's story, I think, is one of the most surprising, powerful accounts of somebody and the decisions he makes and the just perspective he has. Following God step by step, not being distracted, but kind of being faithful in amazing circumstances. So David responds to this task that God has given him. And this is one of the things that I think is hard. It's one of the things I struggle with a lot. You know, how much do I make something happen, and how much does God do it? How much am I responsible for the well-being of my children? And, you know, this is why parents go crazy. It's my job to make sure their lives are okay. Which in some ways, I mean, I have a lot of impact on whether their lives are okay or terrible. And yet ultimately, I can't control that. So where do you find that balance? How do you find out what's my responsibility and how to trust God in the midst of it? And we deal with this in all sorts of areas. But it has to start with the understanding that God is the beginning. That God is ultimately responsible, and he's called me to enter into this, but not to be the final responsibility. So the first thing we need to be convinced of is that it is God who brings success. Well, then the question is, okay, if God brings success, what does success look like? I asked you what you really want, and we had inner peace, pain-free life. What else was said? Nobody said this, but fulfillment, right?
I was going to say it.
Were you? Yeah. See? I read your mind. Yeah, I'm good like that. So, I mean, is this what success is? What is it that success, what is the success that God brings? I think sometimes in the church, we can kind of like over-spiritualize things at times. And we can say that success is this kind of like spiritual thing, and we shouldn't care about earthly things. But listen to the description of success that God brings to his people, Israel. Okay, this is in 2 Samuel 7. I'm going to read starting in verse 8. This is a description of God speaking back to David. And God telling David what he did for him. I'm going to start in verse 8 and read through 11 and then read verse 16. Now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture and from following the flock to be ruler over my people Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest men of the earth. And I will provide a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people will not oppress them anymore, as they did at the beginning, and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders, or judges, over my people Israel. I will also give you rest from all your enemies. Then in verse 16, your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. The days of Israel under the reign of David and into the reign of his son Solomon were the glory days of Israel. They were the days that even today Jews look back on as this is when life was good. Those were the golden years. And what was good about them? From this passage, what did God give them?
Rest.
Rest.
Security.
What else?
Protection
from enemies?
Security is the same as protection.
Yeah. Okay.
Fame,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Offspring,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Power.
Land.
What's that?
Land.
What was land? What did it mean for them?
A lot.
Yeah, a lot. Home.
It was everything.
Like everything. Wealth.
Legacy. Giving them assurance that they would last forever.
Assurance or, like, yeah, some type of kind of immortality almost, like their name would carry on.
Fulfillment of a promise.
Aren't these basically the things that people want? I mean, forget like in church, but in the world, right? People want to be famous. They want to be able to rest. They want to be secure. They want to have money. They want their name to go out. Like, there's nothing spiritual about this. This is what people want. This is success. It's a very earthy description of success. And this is what God gives his people. I think sometimes we, like I said, kind of over-spiritualize it, but basically, I tried to narrow it down, and I think that God basically provided them provision. So they had land, they could grow their crops, that's basically money, right? God provided for them. Everybody could eat and have a place to live and all that. He provided them protection. So their enemies, they beat their enemies couldn't hurt them, nothing bad could happen to them. And he provided them presence. God's presence with them. They could raise their families, they could have community life together. So basically, he made them rich, powerful, and famous, right? I mean, this is what we want, right? You can admit it, even though you're in church. Like, this is what people want. You want to be rich, powerful, and famous. You want provision, protection, and presence. This is success. And this is what God gives his people. a big house, a big fence, and big parties, right? That's what people want in our world. And the people that we look to as the most successful have those things. So, it's interesting because this is what God does for his people. This is the kind of season they had. And then this becomes the model for what God does in history. And so once this season is over, once God's people have lost these things, they look back and they say, God's going to bring us back to that kind of life. That's the way things are going to be. And in a few weeks, we'll talk about the prophets and how the prophets dream about the future that God is bringing. And the future that God is bringing, they often cast in terms of what life was like under King David. This is where the story is going. And so I think it's probably, I think sometimes the church, we kind of do ourselves a disservice by making our version of success sound like something that other people go, well, why would I want to be a Christian? I don't want that. But when you say, what is God really doing? What is the life that he's leading? Where does this story end? It ends with being rich, powerful, and famous. Oh, well, yeah, that's what I want. That is what I want for my life. I want provision. I want protection. I want people around me. I actually want the presence of God if I understand what that really looks like. Now, here's what happens, though. The success that God gives to David doesn't end up lasting. Doesn't end up lasting all that long. So, we need to know that God is the one who brings success. We need to know that success, the success that God is going to bring, is what we want. It's not this kind of super spiritualized, something that you can't relate to. The success that God is bringing, the place this story is going, is what we want. It's what our hearts long for. That's why we have to understand our lives, our stories, in the light of this story. Because this story is headed to the place we want to end up. So God's success is our version of success. But then the third question, the third thing we really doubt is, okay, that sounds nice, but is it really true? Is God really going to bring this? Is this really a real deal? Can I stake my life on it? And I think that for most people that stop believing, who once believed, this plays a big part in it for them. I don't tend to think that intellectual arguments really cause people to stop believing all that much. Sometimes it's tragedy, pain, that plays a big part. But basically, I think people lose faith that God is actually going to do this, that this is actually a real deal, that there is something to look forward to, that there is hope, that this is where that this whole tale is worth believing. So what happens for David is that things kind of fall apart. So I'm going to read from 2 Samuel 24. At the end of David's life, he has this great idea of doing a census. And we're not quite exactly sure why this is such a terrible thing to do. I think there's some cultural things we don't quite get. But it's a bad idea. It's against God's will. And so the result is this in verse 15. So the Lord sent a plague on Israel from that morning until the end of the time designated. And 70,000 of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. When the angel stretched out his hand to destroy Jerusalem, the Lord was grieved because of the calamity and said to the angel who was afflicting the people, "Enough, withdraw your hand." In verse 17, when David saw the angel who was striking down the people, he said to the Lord, "I am the one who has sinned and done wrong. These are but sheep. What have they done? Let your hand fall upon me and my family." God's hand does end up falling on David and on his family. David does not die a glorious death. He kind of fizzles out as a king. The first part of 1 Kings record his elder years. He's old, He can't keep warm, so what they do is they find a young woman to keep him warm. Her name is Abishag. 1 Kings 1, verse 3, it says, they searched throughout Israel for a beautiful girl and found Abishag, a Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The girl was very beautiful. She took care of the king and waited on him. But the king had no intimate relations with her. We might think, oh, he was so pure. Well, that's not what the text is getting at. The text is getting at he's impotent. He's lost his power. This is a picture of a king who has no power left. They've brought him the most beautiful girl in the kingdom, and he can't even do anything about it. And we see then that there's these intrigues behind his back about who's going to be his successor, and he kind of barely manages to establish Solomon as his successor. So David's story is one that ends with kind of a fizzle. And this is what's true about success, in a sense, right? In this world, in kind of until things get finalized, until God returns, you get to be a success, and it's like there's all this pressure, right? The Giants just won the World Series. What about next season? They got to do it again, or they're no longer a success. Being the top means everybody wants to knock you down. And so there's this real insecurity almost about being a success, because now you have to maintain it. You have to keep it going. And what happens is that success fades in this world. I think we've all experienced, one of the questions we'll talk about in our groups is thinking about times we've felt successful. And we realize that those are fleeting times. Something came, but then it goes. And in a sense, that's something to grieve, but partly the reason that happens and what we can learn about that, and when we recognize that in our own lives, what it does is it helps us to realize that there is something more. Disappointment, the disappointment of lost success or of disillusionment, helps us to realize that there's something better coming. There's something more to look forward to. So the failure of David after his success, in a sense, prepares God's people to say, you might think those are the glory years, but there's something better coming. There's something more. And we need to know that. Because, you know, this man waits his whole life for the Giants to win. And if he's really honest, I mean, the Giants win and he goes, oh, well, that was nice, but now what? The success we think we want here isn't really all it's cracked up to be. It's just, we know we want something more. I remember when I was a kid, the season of Christmas, the season of December, you're just like waiting for Christmas to arrive, right? Waiting for the day when you can get up and open the presents. And it's so exciting. And we used to have those little calendars that you like, you know, take off the days. Sometimes we'd get the ones with chocolates inside so you could like eat the chocolate. Every day you're waiting for Christmas. And remember this, it's so exciting, it's so much fun. And then Christmas Day comes and you open your presents. And then it's like, oh, that was it? And it's this like weird sense of disappointment. And it's, I mean, maybe I got exactly what I wanted and I got all these great toys, but you're like, oh, it's over. And even as a kid, I think I realized there's something about the waiting for it that's, in a sense, better than the arrival of it, right? We want to wait for something to come. And the things that we think are going to finally, you know, fulfill us or give us inner peace or whatever, make us feel successful, when they do come, we go, oh, that wasn't quite what I thought it could be. And that's because this story that we are a part of moves forward. The story moves forward to something bigger and better and greater and everything that we want. And we don't always think this way as Christians. The proper stance of a Christian is to be facing forward, to be looking forward to what's coming. And we a lot of times get confused, and we end up looking backward. This is what God's people, the Jews, did. They exalted the days of King David. If only we could go back to to those days. Rather than realizing that God took those days away because he was bringing something better. You don't go back, you go forward to this thing that God is doing in the world. This is the story that we're looking at. Moves forward towards the end, towards the ultimate reality. Or sometimes we just look around and we look at what's going on now and what can I do here? And sometimes we think, I need to learn to live in the present. And in a sense, that's true. There's something about kind of being aware of what God is doing now. But as Christians, our proper stance is always to be looking forward. We always wait what God is doing, the direction his story is moving. The theological term for this is that we are an eschatological people. We look towards the end. That's who we are. That's what defines us. We are people of hope. People who have something to look forward to. Our stories are moving toward a good ending. So, part of the trick for us then is when we feel successful, when we're in a season of success, we need to learn not to be quite so satisfied with what that success is that we're experiencing. We need to realize that this is not all there is. There's something more. We need to learn not to be quite so satisfied with our success, but also not quite so dissatisfied with when things are hard. Because when things are hard, that is God reminding us, I'm giving you this longing, I'm giving you this want, this need to let you know that I'm carrying your story forward towards something good. There is hope. There is hope for you. Now, it's important, I think, that God's story and the story of Scripture goes through this season of success because we need to know that it's possible, right? We need to know that, yes, God did fulfill his promise. God can make things work. We need to have, and God gives us these things, right? He gives us little times in our lives where things work and we go, oh yeah, things can be good. And then we go through harder seasons where we need to learn to hope more. And God carries us through this story, kind of ups and downs, giving us times of success to help us trust him and then times of difficulty to help us hope in him and focus on him instead of our circumstances. So the question that we ask, when will God really bring success? Is this tale really true? We are a people, if we believe in Jesus, we are a people who proclaim, yes, God will actually bring success. That part of the story is critical to what we believe. It's not just believing in Jesus, not just believing that he died for my sins, it's believing that he will return, that the work he's begun, he will complete. That's part of the gospel that we believe.